Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for June 2018. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the Reverend Tim Nelson.
So dour, man. I love it.
I want to get your credentials.
I am revered.
Yeah. I want to get your credentials right out of the way because, like, we talk about a reverend in our movie discussion today, and I want people to know that you've done the work, man. You've gone to seminary. You've read the books. I'm just a layman theologian.
I can marry and bury.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So
And serve communion.
That's an honor. I mean, yeah. It really is. Yeah. So what's new, man? It's time for our new segment at the top where we discuss what we're watching. What have your eyeballs been feasting on lately? Anything new?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So, all right, this is the honest truth.
Okay.
I got into Ken Burns.
Ken Burns, now, the documentary filmmaker.
Right. So I really love Ken Burns, but what I've been rewatching because my kid's playing Little League is his baseball documentary, which is on... I think it's on Prime right now.
Okay.
So I know this is not... I usually am into like single films, but that is what I've been watching is Ken Burns documentary. So I did National Parks, which is all right, but baseball is better. And so if you haven't seen Ken Burns documentaries, they're great.
I've been wanting to watch that for so long. It's super long, right? Like, I mean, that is exhaustive on baseball, which in a good way. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's great for like if you are staying up really late or you just want to watch something, but it's kind of addictive. Just like you talk about television all the time, but yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You come out of it and you're like, oh man, this game is reflects our nation. And anyway, it's just interesting. So I haven't been into like these long format documentary things for a long time, and I just found myself watching Ken Burns more and more and more Ken Burns.
That's awesome.
Just in the mood for it.
And we're right in the thick of baseball season. That's perfect.
Yeah, so it works out great, right? Mm-hmm. So like we're about to hit the All-Star break here and then so it makes more sense. But that's great. It's on Prime right now. You can watch it for whatever your Prime membership is.
Awesome. Well, we watched a movie together recently.
Oh yeah.
We had a little steak night with our good friend Dan Baker, and we watched On the Waterfront, classic Marlon Brando, best picture winner of what year? I don't remember.
1950.
exactly.
I don't know, 54 maybe?
Yep. Something like that. And I was not as impressed as I wanted to be. I hadn't seen it. Dan hadn't seen it. It was Tim's pick, but I don't know. There was something about it. I wasn't blown away like I really wanted to be, but I recognize, what makes it great. Marlon Brando, I like him as an actor. And so that was interesting.
It does. I think one of the things Dan brought up was it comes off like a little melodramatic, right?
Yes.
So
they use all
dun,
this,
dun, dun.
The lingo they use, right? Like, yeah.
And was it Leonard Bernstein was that right? I think he did do the soundtrack or whatever. And it was
euphemism for homelessness is like, you're going to go to Palooka Town. Like
it's like all like old, crazy 20s speak and that thing. Yeah. So it's anyway,
yeah,
but it's still worth watching. Marlon Brando, great performance.
It is.
He's tortured method actor style stuff that's going on. It's great.
Yes.
So yeah, if you want to see On the Waterfront, you can. John would say like, hey, it's not as good as I hoped it would be. I saw the first time and I was really blown away. And the second time, I don't know if it was that the meal was so good that the film didn't look as...
That's true. We had lots of steak and some gin and tonic action.
We were a little tired.
We were tired.
That.
Yeah. So yeah. Maybe on second viewing, I should give it another shot. Yeah.
There you go.
But I'm still on my HBO kick as expected. So I've been going through... Barry. Have you heard of this? This is on with Bill Hader from SNL. He plays this hitman who is like a legit hitman, which is so weird seeing Bill Hader in that role.
So it's like serious?
Serious. Like, but it's dark. I would call it a dark comedy. It is a comedy, but a very dark comedy in that he really is a hitman and he takes his role seriously. But anyway, he happens to do a hit in LA and he wants to get out of the life and he stumbles on this acting class led by Henry Winkler, Yeah, the Fonz. And he is so good in it. Henry Winkler is killing it in his older years, man. He is so good in this show. Anyway, he's this like hardcore acting coach. And so Bill Hader then tries to leave this life of being an assassin to become an actor, but he can't quite escape, the life. And it's a dark comedy. It's got 8 episodes. Henry Winkler's so good. Bill Hader's really good. Really worth your time. So I've been digging that. Yeah. You should check it out.
Hey, excuse me. I'm really sorry about my exercise in class. I really couldn't see anything.
Barry, you want to be an actor?
Mm-hmm.
You better get out of your own way.
Okay.
Life is about taking a risk, making the unsafe choice.
Okay.
All right, here's a little story just to illustrate. I once auditioned for the guy that robbed the house on Full House. And I carried a loaded Beretta with me into the audition just to feel the weight of it.
Wow. Did you get the part?
Oh, they freaked out. Now look, you're in a shell. You need to break out. And I've got the perfect antidote for you. 10 cc's of pure Mammoth.
Mammoth?
Yeah. You're going to play Blake in Glengarry Glen Ross, the movie. I'm going to send you the pages. Here's my only direction. Let the cat out.
That's great, man. Once again, we're giving you TV suggestions on a freaking movie podcast.
Baseball and Barry. So there you go. No, it's all good. We talked about On the Waterfront. It's all good. It's, I think, like, you know, all of our listeners are in the wheelhouse of good art, and that can be TV and movie. And
well, you know how they talk about summer reading? It's supposed to be lighter and, like, more... like something really long that you can, like, I don't know who does this, like go to the pool and read a book for 8 hours. I don't do that. I don't have, for many reasons.
But that's what's so great about TV, but, is like you pop it on 20 minutes and, you know, it's not this commitment. And that's what I love about it. Yeah. And plus, I never get the chance to talk about it because we kind of made a decision early on that Cinema Faith was only going to be about movies because TV is such a, it's so hard to cover. It's such a broad arena. And so this is my chance every now and then to plug some TV action.
We should have a whole podcast on made for TV movies.
Made for TV movies? Yeah. Like what? What's your favorite made for TV movie?
I don't know any made for No, I don't know. I
maybe
don't know.
It, the like the like
oh,
the
see,
old
there you
version.
Go. You like came up with one. I don't know.
Yeah. So here we go, man. Last month was our epic podcast on Infinity War, and that had been like the third big blockbuster that we did. So we thought it was time to take a little chill pill and watch something a little quieter, right? A little more introspective. And I think we chose a good one in that vein. So the movie we're going to be talking about today is the new film by Paul Schrader starring Ethan Hawke, and it is called First Reformed. That is our movie discussion for today. So we're going from a movie that grossed like $2 billion in Infinity War to one that's grossed, I think, a total of $1.8 million. Quite the difference, but I like it. And I'm glad that we can kind of talk about something that's a little quieter and a little less hyped. So... yeah, I'm pumped. Here we go. And Tim and I have not discussed this movie at all. Usually we have this half hour discussion before we start recording, and that discussion's always better than what you hear. So we decided to go fresh. So he's just giving me this blank stare. I don't. He might hate this movie. I don't know. And so this is going to be a great discussion.
I'm like curious about what John thinks. We're a little nervous to share because we don't know. We mean, we like, don't know. I think John might hate this movie. I think he might. I really do think you hate this movie. I really think you do.
Well, we'll see. So... but first off, before we get into that, unlike Avengers Infinity War, there's probably going to be some people who've actually never heard of First Reformed and might need a little plot summary to put some things in context. So
like if you don't live in...
wherever, right? I know we happen to have an indie theater in Milwaukee, which is great, but like one of our dear listeners, Ron, they don't play these movies by him, and he gets frustrated, rightfully so.
So he has to like... wait.
He has to drive like 2 hours if he wants to like actually take in a movie like this.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's commitment. I know. Where's our commitment? We just drive like 10 minutes.
10 minutes, exactly. So if you have not heard of or seen First Reformed, here's a little plot synopsis for you to set the stage. So stars Ethan Hawke as a reverend, the Reverend Toller, and he's in one of the oldest churches in New York. It's not actually a real church. It's like a fictional city, but... in the movie, this is like one of the oldest churches in New York, and it's so old, in fact, that Ethan Hawke's character, Reverend Toller, has to give these tours, like these yuppie tourists come up, and he even has like a gift shop, and like he gives them a hat and everything, and his congregation is what, like 7-8 people on a Sunday,
right?
Something like that. But his parent church is this humongous, classic, high production, big church called Abundant Life. So that's like the parent church, and this is like the baby church that they're holding on to out of nostalgia for this really old church setting. So this reverend guy, he lives right there in the, what do you call that thing that's like the
parsonage?
Parsonage. Or he lives in the parsonage all alone.
I got reverend speak all day long.
Yeah,
you
man.
Just bring it.
That's
and
what
I'll have
I
it
told
for you, man.
You. This guy right here. He lives in the parsonage all alone, and he's really struggling with his faith. faith. He's struggling to kind of like have that connection that he had once with God. He's struggling to pray. So he begins this process of journaling when we first meet him, and that's his form of praying in a fresh way to God. And so we hear kind of his reflections that he writes without editing at the end of every day. And he stays in this little apartment, and he eventually meets this young couple and this husband guy, I think it's the boyfriend of this young couple is like a super environmentalist guy who cares really deeply about the earth. He doesn't even want to bring a child into the world because of what we're doing to it. And that relationship leads down some unexpected paths and ends up taking his faith to new places. And that's all I'll say because I don't want to spoil the movie. We'll save our spoilers for the end because we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the ending, which kind of you have to spoil. So until then, we'll be spoiler-free.
So if you're living in Albert Lea, Minnesota, okay, or what's somewhere else? Paducah, Kentucky, or I'm not mocking any of these places. I've lived in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. But if you're living somewhere like Lancaster, California, or Merced, and you can't get this movie, okay, then you don't want to listen to this podcast. You're going to wait. And when that movie comes, you're going to watch the movie and then listen to the podcast.
Well, you know, but what I'm saying is that we're not going to spoil it for most of it. So you actually can listen to it. It's okay. We're going to really try to be spoiler-free until the ending of the show. So I think they'll be safe for a bit. But okay, if you're one of those people that doesn't want to know anything, then yeah, don't listen to the podcast.
Don't listen to it. Basically, what we're saying is don't listen to the podcast, okay?
Just stop listening to it. Find something else to do.
You need to stop listening to the podcast.
There's plenty of other things to do right now. No. No, we'll try to keep it spoiler light until the end. So
she stopped listening right at the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. My wife listened to about 10 minutes of it and was like, wow, that's cool, and never listened to another.
That's how committed she is not listening to it.
Totally.
She hasn't listened to it for over 30 episodes now.
They're so supportive, our wives. I love it. It's great. All right, so that gives you a little framework to go with. Now let's talk about the writer and director of this movie, a man by the name of Paul Schrader. I was not 100% familiar with this dude, all right? He's been around a long time. Grew up in the 70s, kind of the golden era, right, with Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, kind of a part of that group. So I think you probably were a lot more familiar with him than me. What's your experience with Paul Schrader?
So like deeply disturbing, thought-provoking, slowly developing, almost all male protagonists who are isolated characters. So I'm like thinking of Taxi Driver and then like Raging Bull. I guess he's not quite isolated, but he is isolated by his own rage. So I'm thinking about all those type of characters. I also am thinking particularly of one movie that not a lot of people liked, which is Bringing Out the Dead.
Yeah, yeah, with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. Yep. And I actually like that movie quite a bit.
Me too.
But every single one of these movies is unsettling. Mm-hmm. Like that's the best way I can put it, which is you don't ever feel good at the end of one of these movies.
Sure.
And so I think of his legacy being like, first off, I think of Scorsese because he's obviously worked with Scorsese looking at all these movies.
He's written, like all those movies you mentioned, he was the writer of, mostly directed by Scorsese. His directing career, actually, I didn't recognize hardly any of the movies that he made as a director. He's made like 20 of them, but they're all kind of like, I don't know.
They're
maybe
all
you
like
do.
Deep and kind of junky. So like, yeah, I don't know how. I think he's a really good writer. I don't know if he knows how. I don't know if he edits. Hard to know, because I know I've watched some of the other films, the ones you're talking about, and I was just kind of like, it felt rough.
Right.
That's the best way to put it. Is like it felt rough. It didn't feel like somebody. It's like somebody who can conceptualize things but can't build them. For instance, my kitchen. you know, like that. So it's like, they have this idea, but they can't quite make it work.
But as a writer in the hands of Scorsese, powerful stuff. Like Raging Bull and Taxi Driver, Bringing Out the Dead. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, and then I think the idea of taking characters that you want to, at first you're rooting for, and then you're like at the end you're like, I don't know if I still am like positive.
That plays in a lot to this movie too.
Yeah, you're just kind of screwing with your traditional, you know, story rules that we've talked about so much.
Definitely. So I think as a more of a writer than a director is where I recognized a lot of his work. And I saw Raging Bull back in the day, like maybe 10 years ago. And I remember not liking that as much, but I do very much remember Taxi Driver. And that was definitely one of those films that you saw and you're like, yes, I get why this is great. And so I remember that with, like, you know, that crazy ending with the bloody finger and Jodie Foster and all that. It's like, that's an unforgettable film. I just like, the thing I like about him as a writer is that he just brings a lot of depth to his characters and the world that they inhabit. He just, I remember, like, all of his movies, and I know it's hard to parse what's him and what's Scorsese, but all of his movies have a very rich feeling of place, you know, that his characters live in, and it is kind of oppressive. And
it's almost, so like, I think some of the, like, as I think about the characters, and we're not spoiling anything yet, mm-hmm. I feel like he also flirts with mental illness all the time with his characters. Mm-hmm. And so the idea being, like, that people who are the protagonists who have heroic qualities also have they tend to be out of touch with reality. So you think about Nicolas Cage and Bring Out the Dead, he can't sleep, right? Mm-hmm. So he begins to hallucinate.
That's right.
Or yeah. If you think about Taxi Driver,
yep.
He's basically
yep.
losing it.
Yep.
Or what's some other examples of films? Raging Bull, uh-huh. like Jake LaMotta, right? Uh-huh. Who's based on a real guy. He's beginning to lose his mind. And when at first you're like, hey, this guy can win the fights. And now you're just kind of like, this guy's already lost something. And and so he's dealing with mental illness in his hero characters, which, you know, I don't know if anybody talks about that or not, but it's like they don't quite have a grasp on what reality is, yet they still want to, like, have impacts on reality mm-hmm. and be heroic in some way. But in a lot of cases, they're losing it.
And they deteriorate throughout the course of the movie.
Well, yeah. That's his deal.
That's his thing. Yeah. It's his MO. This was one of those movies that really, a lot of lines stood out to me as like, wow, that is a great line. Like, that's powerful writing. You know, it was one of those scripts that just is razor sharp. What did you think of him as a writer in this?
He's an excellent writer. He's it's full of allusions. Even like the main character, Ernst Tuller, is a real guy.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So anyway, we can talk about that later.
Definitely.
So we don't spoil anything. There's also a poem that was written by W.H. Auden about Ernst Toller that this whole film is referencing. So he's like very literary, right?
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, it's good stuff. I mean, and his son is Joseph and the woman is Mary. And like, it's just like there's all this, anytime you see scripture or symbolism or any of that stuff, it's very intentional.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as a writer, yeah, I think he's good. I think.
Were there any lines that stood out to you?
I think when the megachurch pastor talks to Toller and he's like, you always got to be in the garden.
Yeah.
And he's like, and then also there's a line when he's in the graveyard. And I think it's something like some people are so, God uses some people's, it's something like some people are so empty and that God uses that emptiness to save or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of like the person that is totally knows the depths of brokenness could be that. So it's like they know the negative space of goodness.
Yeah.
that person, that's not what he said, but that person might actually be the person that has the ability to save
mm-hmm.
or at least to be worked for God to use. So those are interesting ideas.
I like when he says in one of the voiceovers, he says something like, how easy it is to talk about prayer for those who've never really prayed. That's such a powerful line. There was that one point too where he's talking to the woman about, there was this woman that he apparently had some sort of one night stand with or something that he talks to. And she's like, do you think, you know, we sinned? And he's like, I've seen enough real sin to know the difference.
We're inside baseball in this movie, and we're not always that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you know, a lot of times because, like, especially, like, I'd say particularly me, because this guy is a Calvin grad, and this movie got screened to seminarians before it got screened to anyone else.
Wow. Yeah.
So it actually went to Calvin, Fuller, and Yale before it went anywhere else.
I didn't know that. That's great.
So, like, he's... Like, this is, yeah.
Uh-huh. This is our, yeah.
This guy is, like, probably closest to what my preferences would be as far as, like, just naturally. Like
uh-huh.
Affinity. Like, we are in the same affinity group.
You know, Calvin College is right down the road from where I went to school, Cornerstone University. It's, like, right, you just take the road right down. It's about 5 minutes away, so, yeah.
So, it's kind of like, that's, like, the, you know, I guess I got into Calvin, didn't go. Mm-hmm. because I was 18 and they had bad nachos and I was from San Diego.
Bad nachos.
I'm totally serious. I was like, I can't go here. I can't live like this.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know if that was a mistake or not, but it's like a really, really good school.
Yeah.
I mean, like from the standpoint of it's as far as the Christian liberal arts schools, it's an excellent institution.
Jack White was going to be a priest, but they wouldn't let him bring his amp. So, you know, he became a rock star. It's amazing.
At Calvin?
Not at Calvin, but one of those Christian schools. Huh. It's amazing. I wonder how many other people were rejected or just kind of walked out because of something like bad nachos, and then they could have become
It's how the Lord filters us out.
That's right. That's right.
It's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to use the nachos on this guy. Yep.
It's awesome.
But I guess what I'm saying is, like, this is like his dialogue should work on you and me. I mean, like, you're a white guy from the same region.
Yeah.
Who has a theological bent, Christ following dude with the same, a lot of similar sensibilities. He's actually probably more, as far as his literary sensibility, he's probably more like my father than like me because he's 71 or 72 years old. So he's older. Yeah. So like all the references, like even there's Thomas Merton references, and I know Merton's a classic, but Merton was like a revolutionary, like, you know, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now it's like, oh, this is classic. So as far as like his own or even W.H. Auden references, like those are a little dated in some ways. I deeply respect those, but yeah, they're definitely within the like white male tradition.
For sure. Yeah, Merton was very Merton's prominently Catholic, displayed on his on his desk. And like that, speaking of someone who's always like in the garden, he's definitely one of those people, right?
Yeah, I think he was a needed corrective to bring Protestants into monastic thinking, ways of thinking. So spiritual disciplines and fasting and prayer and contemplative prayer. So I think like Merton's a really positive figure as far as a lot of Protestants, but anyway, yeah.
Hey, I've got to mention a special shout out to the voiceover in this movie. I know I always do a voiceover rant like every time we podcast, it feels like, but I loved the use of voiceover in this movie because it was another character. It added another layer to the scenes because the voiceover wasn't just, you know, given pipe randomly out of nowhere. It was like prayers to God that connected with what was happening on screen. And I thought it was so beautiful and well handled. So this, ladies and gentlemen, is how you do voiceover right here.
So
Exhibit A.
So this technique he steals from another film.
What is it?
Called Pickpocket. It's a Bresson, I think. Bresson. And I could be mispronouncing it. I just don't know. He's French. So I'm just making, I just go on at the end. But yes, yeah, so like that's not new to have that technique, but the technique is that his actual internal dialogue would outnumber the lines. Like that's like one of the things that they go that technique would go for. So most of his films, a lot of his films have functioned as homage to that one movie Pickpocket, which I've never seen.
Okay, so I'm not either.
What can we talk about? I don't know about it. But I just thought that was interesting. A lot of people knew that, people that know more about film than I do.
Well, from a directing standpoint, I know someone who also knows more about film than I do pointed out to me that there was a shot of when Ethan Hawke is pouring Pepto-Bismol into his alcohol.
Yeah.
That apparently is a reference to Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, I think, actually. Taxi Driver, where Bickle is putting Alka-Seltzer into his water, and that is a reference to this French director, Godard? Godard, yeah.
Jean-Luc Godard?
Yeah, which is like a shot of bubbles in a drink. So like reference to a reference visually.
Right, which I think is he does that, like, so he's doing that like at a literary level, at a visual level.
Yes.
To some degree, like you might say, oh, he's got all these facets, but I would also say he likes to make a little puzzle for us too.
Yeah.
It's like overactive imagination.
Yeah, for sure. And I thought as a director, he was magnificent. So I've never seen his other movies, so I have nothing to compare it to, but I really thought he brought a delicate touch to the movie. Like, yeah, I had some problems with how he handled the home stretch, but as far as most of the movie, it reminded me a lot of Tree of Life, this very meditative movie that kind of really depicts faith. Like, the real mise-en-scene to me of the movie is faith lived out in the real world. And that informs every choice that he makes as a director. And I just thought that it's really hard to depict faith on screen. It's hard to do it without being cheesy or overwrought. And I thought most of the movie was handled so subtly and nothing felt too long, too drawn out. I thought he was a great at directing in this. What did you think of him as like a director?
So I liked him. I think that, You know, I didn't look at the cinematography because I wasn't like particularly moved by it. I'm sure it's good. I don't know who did it. What do you know?
I don't either about who actually did the cinematography, but it did stand out to me. Like, special, there's a way that he shot scenes that he made mundane scenes really come alive. Like, even if you think about him at a just giving a checkup at a doctor's office, the way he chose to arrange the shots. One that really stood out to me was when there's this point where Ethan Hawke is like serving soup at a soup kitchen, and he accidentally pours soup on this this guy in a wheelchair or whatever, and he runs to help the guy, but the camera stays on the blank wall behind him. You know, there's little things like that.
So it actually made it more disorienting.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that scene.
Yeah, so there were little flourishes like that.
I love the first scene.
Yeah.
Because the first scene is that it's like late fall and the trees are just, there's nothing left as far as leaves and everything. Mm-hmm. And that you come very, very slowly rising up, and way at the top of the screen is this white church that is like at the center of everything. Yeah. And so like the whole world is like dormant, but that church is like rising on the horizon, this big white steeple.
And it's a long glide, like, right?
It's like huge. Like 10, the shot takes 5 minutes, forever.
Something like that, yeah.
But the idea is like that this is in the midst of all their, you know, so the idea is in the midst of this dying world, right? Even if it's just fall, right? Mm-hmm. There is this thing.
Yes.
That is the hope, right?
Yeah.
And so I love that first shot that it took so long because it made us think about it.
Yep.
So I totally dug that shot. Some of the meditative shots are like really, I mean, it looks like, you know, like whistlers. I mean, it's like really dark.
Mm.
I like those too. I love the Spartan nature of like he's inhabiting that giant house that's probably meant for how many, it's like, you know, where these heroic creature types lived 250 years ago that were like the leaders of the entire community, and now he's like given tours.
Yeah.
And gets tipped for the tours, you know? And he's just not respected.
He only has size small on the hats and they're disappointed. Just like it's so.
Yeah, he can't even do the tours
it's
well.
Like a caricature. Yeah.
So this thing that was once this hope of the whole community, and like, and it also is like the aspirations of the community too, has now become a museum.
Mm.
And so I see that as like one of the things, but I mean, so the church itself almost has personality in the movie.
Yep.
And that he would live in this manse. That's like this gigantic kind of beautiful building that has no furniture at all.
That's falling apart.
Well, yeah, it's falling apart, but it's got no furniture. It looked like a governor's mansion almost.
Mm-hmm.
He's using like just one little section of the place, but then he writes all throughout it.
Yeah.
But he's occupying this big empty house.
Yeah.
And it that once had power, that once had life in it, and now there isn't life in it. There's no power in it. And I thought like those visuals and the symbols are pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was I think they did well as far as the camera, like the cinematography in that sense is that you felt that.
Yep. And you kind of, I mean, that's a reflection of the inner turmoil that's going on inside Tuller.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So before we leave off of Schrader, I did want to mention that this guy, he does kind of have a fascinating upbringing. So you already mentioned that he went to Calvin, but I was just doing some research because I didn't know anything about him. But this is what, I found a biography, and just let me read this a second. It says, although his name is often linked to that of the movie brat generation, Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, Coppola, Lucas, Paul Schrader's background couldn't have been more different from theirs. His strict Calvinist parents refused to allow him to see a film until he was 18. Yeah, man. So he had this really strict Calvinist upbringing. He eventually went to Calvin in Grand Rapids. But this is a direct quote from him about his upbringing. He said, "We believed in a very real hell and very real evil. My mother took my hand once and stabbed me with a needle. And she said, you know how that felt when the needle hit your thumb? Well, hell is like that all the time." That was his upbringing. Like, right. So that definitely informs his work.
So you can see how he's very, very literary. There are elements of this that are... Yeah, you've got to know some like what he's alluding to. You've got to know, so you don't have that in film much anymore.
I know,
and because we're spending our time watching Ken Burns and what was your movie?
Barry.
Yeah, because we're not reading books anymore. Uh-huh. You might be. I'm not reading that many books anymore. So like he's doing all these references. We're not really picking up on him all the time. But I would say like, yes, he's definitely like a novelist who happens to be a screenwriter.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. You know? Right. And one thing else I wanted to mention was, do you remember that terrible Terrence Malick movie we saw Song to Song last year?
Yes.
Where we were like dying in this movie, man. Well, Schrader wrote a review of this movie, but it's very short. It's one line. He wrote it on Facebook. He hated it, just like us.
Yes.
This is what he said verbatim on Facebook after seeing Song to Song. Quote, "If you could photograph the unwanted urine which dribbles from an old man's penis, you'd have a film like Song to Song." That is like, that's some major shade on Malick, man. He just put that out
on
Facebook.
And they're in the same generation.
Right? Calling him out. Maybe that's what prompted Malick to announce that he's changing styles back to a script, thank God. So, yeah,
did he?
Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, he's going back to a script for his next feature.
Well, if he wants to get any funding, he's going back to a script. He better change it some way. And then he'll cut everything out. Yeah, we shouldn't give him any more airtime. This is too much for Terrence.
But I loved it.
I like that they don't like each other, yet they're both like really intelligent, literary, and even would like have a lot of probably faith stuff in common.
Yeah, and they actually do have similar styles as far as, like, I would say the first hour of this really feels like Tree of Life to me in the way faith is depicted. So yeah, they hate each other, but they're on like on the same wavelength.
Well, I think Tree of Life's a good film.
It's so good. It's in my top five of all time.
Not Song to Song.
Song to Song is so bad.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Let's talk about acting. Ethan Hawke. I love Ethan Hawke, Tim. I have a man crush on Ethan Hawke. I think he's the coolest guy, and I think he's a great actor. What are your thoughts on him? Please don't tell me you don't like him.
No, I like Ethan Hawke, all right.
All right.
I'm not like, he doesn't overpower me. Like, as far as like,
he's just so solid. Like, just every time he just brings it. I don't know. He's one of those guys. Yeah. What are your thoughts on him? Like, what are you, what stands out when you think back on Ethan Hawke films you've seen? Is there one that's like
Dead Poets Society and then Boyhood?
Yep, like Boyhood, that's
ones,
right.
Those are the ones I think. So, like, Dead Poets Society, he's a kid, basically. He's, like, maybe, 17 or something? Mm-hmm.
That was, like, his third movie.
Yeah, so I think about, was he in, like, some Goonies or something?
No, he was in this movie, and credit to Jason Thompson, a friend of mine who I saw First Reformed with, he knew this right off the bat, what his first film was. By the way, go back into our archives and look up Hell or High Water if you want to
to...
Yeah, it was the only time that I have podcasted with anyone else besides you, Tim.
And you did a great movie. I was like, you just gave me the horrible movies.
Yeah, you were on vacation or something. You missed out on this fantastic movie, and I had an hour-long conversation with Jason Thompson, who's a great guy, and you should listen to that podcast. Anyway, after the movie, Jason Thompson knew off the top of his head that Ethan Hawke's first movie came out in 1985, and it's called Explorers. And it's like this...
Oh, I know Explorers.
You know Explorers.
Yeah, sure.
I've never seen it. It's got River Phoenix in it.
Yeah.
That was his very first movie.
I didn't know that was his first... I'm not following Ethan. I don't like go, oh, a new Ethan Hawke movie. That's not me.
Yeah.
I just know that he has a good reputation for wanting to be in meaningful movies.
Yes, very much so.
And being willing to like get on board as far as producing and all that stuff. So
there's a great quote by him that I remember seeing once where he was like, I met a ton of famous people when I was like 24 and I realized that they weren't that great of people. And so I realized I don't need that at all. Right. So you can definitely see that path of his where he's like, okay, I don't need to be a celebrity. I'm good, right? That's Ethan Hawke.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So he wants to be an actor, probably get a paycheck at some point, but he's not driven to be in, like, you know, I don't know.
Avengers movie?
Yeah, he's not going to be an Avenger.
He's not going to be an Avenger.
Like, we want Ethan Hawke, and they're like, no, we don't.
But you're right. So 85 was his first movie, and 4 years later, 89 was Dead Poets Society, which is he's really good in that. He really is. I'll never forget that scene where he finds out that his roommate committed suicide and he just can't believe it. And he's like stumbling through the snow in his like nightgown or whatever. Like, it's just great gripping acting in that. And that's when he like first got started. But he's made so many good movies. He was in White Fang. That was one of my favorite childhood movies, right? Come on.
I can't hate on Sled Dogs, man. What can I say?
Yeah, exactly. Training Day. I think a lot of people forget how good Ethan Hawke is in Training Day because Denzel, you know, is like the showy performance and he won an Oscar. But you should go back and rewatch that specifically for Ethan Hawke.
I've seen that movie several times.
Yes.
I used to think that was a cool movie, and now I kind of hate that movie.
Oh, why do you hate it? That's a great film.
Because it's full of stereotypes, and basically hood parody to me.
Yeah,
like, I can't like that kind of stuff gets me kind of worn out now.
That's a fair criticism. But Ethan Hawke as the straight cop who is like being pulled throughout this whole movie toward compromise and refuses to give in. It's a great performance. But if I had to pick one, it would be the Before Sunrise trilogy where he plays Jesse and falling in love with this girl named Celine. Have you seen...
This is Linklater movies?
Linklater, yes.
Yeah, I haven't seen them still.
Oh, Tim.
I don't like...
All right, we're going to pause the podcast and go watch all three and we'll come back. No, I'm just kidding. That's so sad.
So it's not my fault. I just don't want to pay to watch them.
But you love Linklater. I've got them all. You're going to borrow them from me and you're going to watch them.
I won't watch them with you. Aren't they like romantic?
Yeah, you don't want to watch it with me. That's weird. But like you need to watch them because it's Linklater.
But I'm so much more into like a white male struggling alone while drinking.
Yes.
That's what the movies I like have in them. This doesn't have that, does it?
Well, if you're not Tim Nelson and you're interested, you should watch Before Sunrise. Start there. It's basically three films, but what's unique about them is that they take place in real time. So this first, Before Sunrise, is basically this college student just kind of Europe-ing all over around, and he runs into this girl on this train and they fall in love in real time and you fall in love with them in real time. And then this Before Sunset is they meet up again 10 years later and have another real time conversation. It just feels like you're spending an hour and a half with two people in real time. That's beautiful. It's beautiful. Yeah. I love it.
That's how people should feel when they listen to this.
Yeah, hopefully.
No.
All right, I have an admittedly insane idea, but if I don't ask you this, it's just, you know, it's going to haunt me the rest of my life.
What?
I want to keep talking to you, you know? I have no idea what your situation is, but I feel like we have some kind of, connection, right?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right, well, great. So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the town.
What?
Come on, it'll be fun.
What would we do?
I don't know. All I know is I have to catch an Austrian Airlines flight tomorrow morning at 9:30, and I don't really have enough money for a hotel, so I was just going to walk around, and it'd be a lot more fun if you came with me. And if I turn out to be some kind of psycho, you know, you just get on the next train. All right. Think of it like this. Jump ahead 10, 20 years, okay? And you're married. Only your marriage doesn't have that same energy that it used to have. You know, you start to blame your husband. You start to think about all those guys you've met in your life and what might have happened if you picked up with one of them, right? Well, I'm one of those guys. That's me. You know, so think of this as time travel from then to now to find out what you're missing out on. See, what this really could be is a gigantic favor to both you and your future husband to find out that you're not missing out on anything. I'm just as big a loser as he is, totally unmotivated, totally boring, and you made the right choice and you're really happy.
Let me get my bag.
Yeah, so I'm not, I like Ethan Hawke, all right. I'm not drawn to him. I wouldn't go to a film because it was Ethan Hawke, but I like that he's got some kind of, it seems like he's pretty ethical in the sense of like he's very selective in his films.
Yeah. He used to be married to Uma Thurman. Did you know that?
No.
And they have kids but he did cheat on her, and Quentin Tarantino's a little beef there because Quentin Tarantino's obsessed with Uma. And
I know.
Yes, I did clickbait all of this last night at 12 o'clock at night, and it was fantastic.
I'm willing to forgive you.
Everyone does it. Don't judge me. We all do it. All right, Tim. So how about Ethan Hawke in this movie specifically? What do you think he brings to the character of Reverend Toller? Did you like the performance?
I like what he's able to draw us into Toller, and in some ways Toller is a narcissist.
Oh, interesting.
And he's able to bring us, like, because he's self-obsessed in some ways. And the more I reflected on this film, the more I was like, dang, you are self-obsessed. Mm. So he was able to bring like this like kind of dignified self-obsession versus like what our current president does.
Right.
But the idea of like, remember when, so this guy's like struggling and he's suicidal in this film, mm-hmm. one of the guys that he's counseling. Mm-hmm. And
that's the environmentalist guy, this young couple.
And when he's talking with him, he's like talking about like he's getting high. It's like pleasurable for him to talk to this guy. And he's like, I haven't felt so exhilarated in so long. And then
he brings it up, this like wrestling with the angel or something. He mentioned it like as like his debating with this guy feels to him like he's wrestling with God. Yeah.
It's yeah.
Like,
and he's
in a good way.
Right. I mean, so like for him, it's like this, like he feels again, he hasn't felt for a long time. So yeah. He's kind of like using people to feel again.
That's really interesting.
He does it with the guy's wife too. Because he's like emotionally vacuous in some ways. Like he's like all he can, like he feels pain, and he feels anger and he feels some of these other things that you see in the film. But in a lot of ways, he's isolated, he's hyper isolated, he's in destructive patterns of behavior.
Yep.
And the dude is, he's not even functioning pastorally either. So like he gives the tour, he does a good job on the tour. But like, you know, when horrible events occur, he does not act very pastoral. He does like the very minimum amount and he doesn't like show empathy to people.
Yeah.
So the way he's written is he's a little bit cold, a little aloof and super like he's not well. Like he's very clearly disturbed and not well.
It's one of those guys where you make a joke and he's like, oh, I've never heard that before. It's like, okay.
And he's not able to connect with people very well.
Yep.
Like he can't feel, he's not able to have empathy, like true empathy, like, or like, so there's some parts of him that are a little sociopath, right?
Definitely.
But at the same time, Hawk is able to make that character a little likable. Like, so you'd want to be like, oh, you know what? Oh, he's just going through a spiritual struggle.
Yeah.
And he'll come out okay, you know?
Yeah.
Because he is a likable actor. Yeah. Because like, he just has a likable face, you know?
That baby face, yeah. Yeah. You like him.
And he did a good job looking like his kind of troubled self was actually on a quest for meaning or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was able to achieve like being deeply troubled and also have a heroic bent to him in the same...
That's so interesting because I definitely resonated with him as this kind of heroic guy trying to rekindle his faith and live out his faith in the real world. But I totally see what you're saying about this undercurrent of narcissism that's kind of overclouding everything that he does, especially towards the end there. So, yeah, that's good. It's a good observation.
Yeah. I mean, he comes back and he relates everything to his pain every time.
Yeah.
And so it's like everyone else's pain, he relates directly to his pain. And like that's... even like I think about my own experience in like recovery groups and stuff, sometimes you just like people just have pain and you just listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always trying to relate his suffering in this film, which mm-hmm. I don't know. Can we talk about that? Like that's pre. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So like his son he basically convinced his son to go into the Virginia Military Institute and then to war. And he died within 6 months of being in the war.
Yeah. That's all backstory. It's not.
That's all backstory. Yeah. And his wife is like, leaves him.
Yeah.
Because she's like, I can't live with this man anymore because after the son dies, because he convinced my son to go kill himself.
Right.
Basically. Yeah. So anyway, so you start off with this, and he's a military chaplain. Anyway, so you start out with that kind of, this is the background of it. So mm-hmm. everything in his life relates to that pain.
Yeah. Like Amanda Seyfried, I think that's how you pronounce it. Is the girl in this young couple. And, you know, she just asks him to pray for her. But instead of just being the selfless act of prayer, he's got to talk about how the words came out. But, you know, and then quotes a Bible verse about we'll be judged by our words. And everything relates back to his spiritual funk and right and,
yeah. he even goes, I wonder, he says like, should I have done something differently, could I have said, you know, like, and like, so instead of like being with this woman
mm-hmm. who's grieving,
like, who's right. grieving, like in the
we won't say why
who's grieving, like in the midst of a, you know, a deep grief, he's totally unable to connect with her grief, and he just connects it back directly to his ego.
Exactly.
And you're like, oh, what?
And
you're whack.
The relationship that he has with that woman that he had a fling with once is really fascinating too, because she brings out emotions that I think he's scared of. Like, she's just very concerned for him, and I don't know why he's so opposed to it, but he like flips out on her at one point and calls her a stumbling block. And definitely you see that, like, a sociopath is a little harsh, but definitely that flare up of like, dude, what are you doing? You know? And yeah, she triggers something in him that's really raw.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's like this element of codependence, and then, you know, that you see in, so like if he wants company, he'll go have lunch with her.
Mm.
Or if you, and they allude to that, like an affair in the past.
Yeah.
So, or, you know, maybe not an affair, but like, you know, they had been intimate. Mm-hmm. And so like if he wants intimacy, then he doesn't owe her anything.
Yeah.
So like the idea being like that when he wants something from her, he'll do that. But when she wants intimacy or to care for him or whatever, and she's really codependent. Like,
yeah.
So that's built into that character, for sure. Which is like, she just wants to take care of him. And like, as soon as she starts doing that, like he gets disgusted by her.
Yes.
And he's like, get away from me.
He even says that. I'm disgusted by you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like when she exhibits all this extreme codependence, and so it's like, it's unhealthy. Like they match unhealthily,
mm-hmm.
but, and I think he's probably aware of that. I don't know. But so he's not as innocent as a figure as we want him to at first appear.
Yep. Yeah. And Amanda Seyfried's in the movie too. She is good. I wouldn't say she's like, you know, stands out as this amazing performance, but she's solid in it. Amanda Seyfried, you might know her from the trailer to Mamma Mia 2, Here We Go Again, which I've seen probably 30 times because it's in before every movie of 2018. And every time I see it, I want to see it less. But she's fine. Don't stop.
Oh, sorry.
She's great. She's fine. And all around, the acting is impeccable. But Ethan Hawke really is. The movie's on his shoulders, and he carries it. And with those dual, that dual role of you feel for the guy, but there's an element of him that is not well, unstable, like all Schrader's characters. So, all right, let's fast forward to the ending, because there's a lot to talk about in the ending here. And this is where elicited the strongest reaction from me.
So yeah. For listeners, like, because okay. We didn't quite give the whole movie.
Right.
Can you fill us in? Because there's a whole middle section too.
Yeah. You mean as far as like what happens
in
the movie? Yeah, definitely. So this is a time to give our spoiler alert. If you've not seen First Reformed, we're going to kind of spoil things for you. Go ahead and skip ahead a little bit in the podcast, because we're going to come back around at the end. If you want to be totally fresh, this is your spoiler alert. So basically, there comes a point where things take a turn tonally in First Reformed. So we mention Amanda Seyfried in this, and her boyfriend are like this young couple that he counsels. And her boyfriend's a super environmentalist guy who's like, doesn't want to bring a baby in the world because he's so disgusted by what we're doing to the world. And he ends up killing himself kind of as a martyr for the environment, it's alluded to. Like, he cares so deeply about it that he...
But it's also like a deep despair.
And in despair, right.
So
yes.
Like, he has actual deep despair.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, even in the, this is where I was talking about, there is a real Ernst Toller who killed himself because he had deep despair because of,
killed himself. Okay.
So Ernst Toller is this German, I think he's an artist or something. And his he finds out that his family gets put into a concentration camp, and he does all these things to try to, like, you know, this is 1939 in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets to this point where he's just like, the world is falling apart and I don't want to be part of it anymore. And so he kills himself. Anyway, wow. So W.H. Auden writes a poem about him, and he's talking about how a lot of times it's like our, you're talking about the events of the world, mm-hmm. that surround us can impact even our emotions, but also like, and then it can affect like our zeitgeist can affect like everything about us, including our own decisions, like when it would come to suicide, which I thought was, anyway, it's really interesting stuff.
It is.
But Auden also wrote like it was like this big poem called The Age of Anxiety, which Leonard Bernstein. We had a Bernstein connection on the waterfront.
Yes.
Here we go. So he wrote also a score, some kind of music called The Age of Anxiety, but it's about people who were in that same era learning to live in an increasingly industrial era.
Okay.
Which deeply connects. So that totally connects with this environmentalism stuff. And also, Schrader is like totally on board with all this environmental stuff. Like, he thinks like, okay, it's done. We're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, this, like, there isn't hope as far as environmentally, like, he would be very much on that, on like, in his real life.
Yeah.
It's like, now we've basically destroyed the earth.
Well, when you look at the data, yeah, it's pretty convincing. They presented in the movie, there was basically some cutoff point where we were supposed to do something by a certain year and we didn't do it. And it's like, that's, yeah, it. Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you do? So this connects directly to the Ernst Toller character.
Mm.
So what do you do when, like, there isn't hope?
Yeah.
And how do you handle that? Like, what is your way you can, you know, that you can, what can you do? And so, like, I guess this guy gets suicidal, right?
Yep. He gets suicidal and he kills himself because he gives into the despair. And basically what happens is that Ethan Hawke finds a jacket, a explosive vest that he had been storing in his garage for we don't know what, maybe some political act, or he was going to do something on behalf of the environment. And he takes it home with him. And this is kind of where the movie takes a turn, is you really see Ethan Hawke kind of poring over this dude's laptop and the data, and he, Abundant Life, their parent church, is like connected to this oil tycoon and blah, blah, blah. And so he starts to really kind of follow in the footsteps of this kid, and he begins to ask himself, what are we doing to the earth? And he's also diagnosed with this like condition. I think he has a tumor. I think they're alluding to the fact that he's going to die anyway from a tumor. So he starts to form this dark plan, which is where the movie tonally shifts from sort of a meditative first hour to kind of very dark, like Taxi Driver-ish. Like,
it basically jumps on the Taxi Driver rails.
Yes.
Like, exactly that. You're like, yep, oh, is he forming a knife that slips out of his sleeve? You know, like that kind
right
of, you're like, oh, this is Taxi Driver.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it is. It's exactly Taxi Driver.
Yes. So there's this 200th like anniversary for the historic
250.
Church. 250, sorry. Oh, yeah. 250th anniversary for this big, for this church, and everyone's going to be there, including all of these oil giants and politicians and bigwigs.
The governor.
And the ending is basically his plan is he's going to put on this vest and he is going to blow himself up in front of these people. And
It's a suicide bomb. So he's going to hopefully take them out too, right?
Well, see, that's what I want to get into in a minute. But anyway, what ends up happening is that he is interrupted because Amanda Seyfried, who he's formed a relationship with, shows up unexpectedly at this service, and suddenly he's all like, no, I can't do that anymore. And he switches to this barbed wire that he wraps around himself, which is also environmentally connected because these rabbits were like killing themselves on it. And he's about to kill himself with like Drano in a cup, and she shows up unexpectedly in his house, and they run to each other and to the music of Everlasting Arms, Passionately Kissed, roll credits. Yeah. And that is the ending to this movie. So what was rolling through your mind when those credits came up? Were you jiving with this whole path that this movie started to take there?
So, like, as soon as he starts getting vested up.
Yeah, yeah.
No, your vestments actually are like your priestly stuff.
Your
so I don't know. Like, he does things like, we get led down that path of going, well, maybe this is okay. Like, when they show that the secret door for the Underground Railroad in the church, you're like, well, maybe the church should be involved in these things.
Right.
Maybe we should do something more than just preach.
Yeah.
And then you're like, maybe we should blow up the governor. And you're like, wait a minute. Really?
Yeah.
I think, and like Taxi Driver in some ways, although Taxi Driver, it seems like you're a little bit more clued into this guy ain't well. This one, you're like beginning to go, well, maybe this isn't as crazy as I thought it was. Now, I really don't like this bulk guy who's like the guy that's, you know, sponsoring everything. Maybe the church should take a stance. Maybe we should blow up some stuff.
You're like, I'm bored with it.
You start, well, like, yeah, he basically becomes kind of like a holy war, so like a martyr, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and they refer to jihadism and radicalism in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of gets radicalized in his isolation.
Here's my question. Because the reason why I absolutely hated this ending at first and I was so mad about it is because I did not buy that he would suddenly turn homicidal and want to take out these people in this building. But what I remembered, and see if you think I'm right here, he watched this video of someone blowing himself up in the street.
Yeah.
And he watched it several times. And in that video, the people around him did not die. They weren't like blown up too. They were like, seemed to be okay. And I'm wondering if he watched that specifically to tell that if he blows up this vest, it's only him that really is going to be hurt by this. Because I could see him like playing the martyr. I cannot see him being homicidal and blowing up that whole church. That doesn't make sense to me.
I think I look at it as like that's what he's doing. It's the homicidal
really?
Part.
You thought that's what he was, that was his intention. Because if that's true, then I hate this ending. And I feel like Schrader is like hacking Christianity for his own sordid purposes. I just don't buy it. I don't think it fits with the character that they present in the first half. A character who cares about Jesus, who cares about justice, about life, this baby inside of Amanda Seyfried, right? Like, there's no way that he's just going to take out 100 people. I feel like I have to believe that he has enough of a distance away from this thing that he's going to make a radical statement by blowing himself up because his body is marked anyway with a tumor, and that's what his plan was. But maybe I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, I hate it.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I do think that he was going to try to blow these folks up because the idea is that they, you know, as a, you know, some way to honor her husband's death and I think he wants martyrdom.
But is martyrdom, that's not the same thing as, yeah, well, I guess you're talking about jihad, right? Yeah.
So what I thought was interesting is like you don't, in this Abundant Life church, there's no opportunity for martyrdom. So like he might have gotten like, and he's a contemplative, and what he deeply wants, like this deep connection with God, and he's always in the garden, meaning he's always on his bleeding from, you know, praying so hard, and he's bleeding as he prays, and he's suffering. So suffering becomes this primary form of spirituality, right? So that like that he's like would take his own life.
That I understand.
And
right.
But it would also like solve some problems. Within a justice vein, right? Uh-huh. So like within like the Underground Railroad vein. That would make some sense. Like that would be right with it. But I also think that you do have Dead Poets Society Ethan Hawke in your head when you look at Ethan Hawke.
Probably.
And this character is much darker.
And the moral character of even Training Day and things like that. Right. I kind of do associate Ethan Hawke with playing moral characters.
But he's not moral in this movie. Mm. Like he's lying. He's an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
He is totally disassociated from everyone.
Yeah. And narcissistic, like you said, and combine that's a toxic combination, right?
Right. He's in tons of pain,
mm-hmm.
but he's not willing to talk to anybody about it. So he's just very isolated. Now, none of those things, like if you're a listener and you're struggling with something like that, like this is, I'm not trying to condemn you. I'm just saying like the next step is you need to get in relationship with somebody.
Yep.
Like talk to somebody. Like that's really critical. And so, but he's not there. Like he pushes people away that actually want to have real conversations with him.
So did you like the ending? Do you think it was a fitting ending?
So I read some stuff that talked about the kiss. Like I look at, and maybe this is because of the way I was raised, I looked at the kiss as being more amorous. But when he was interviewed, Schrader's interviewed about it, he wanted the kiss to look like peaceful, like it was the idea of embrace.
Like a deep embrace.
Like even when in the where they were, he kind of has this like Carlos Castaneda like otherworld hallucination experience when she lays on top of him fully clothed,
floating
or whatever
in
they call
the
it.
Air and yeah.
Yeah, so it's like this mystical experience that he has with her. You know, she needs pastoral care, and like so he has this mystical experience in connection with her. Like he experiences the divine as he experiences her.
And she's like a Mary figure, as my friend pointed out, Jason, when we saw the movie together.
Well, she is Mary, right?
She's Mary,
and
right.
She's pregnant. Yeah. And
her boyfriend mentions something about when the baby is 33 or something like that, right? Which is very it kind of gets you there.
So, but the idea is like she's vulnerable but she would be like the source of kind of divine power to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Which that was kind of interesting. But I think one of the things that they talk about is he dead at that point?
Dad?
Dead.
Oh, dead.
So he would always, when they were doing the screenings, because it actually got started getting screened in 2017, but when they started doing screenings of the film, he would ask the audience, like, is he alive? How many of you think so? Is he dead? How many think so? And he left it ambiguous.
Schrader said that. Yeah. So that's coming right from the creator.
So the idea being like, that might be heaven.
Yeah.
For him.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So like,
in the everlasting
arms. He might have drank the Drano.
The Drano.
And
or blown himself up when he was trying to get the vest off, right? Who knows, right? Like, yeah.
But so that might have been like what heaven looked like for him, which is to be, yeah, to be in her arms and to be in the embrace part. The kiss is important, but like, it's like more like, it's like he's in deep connection with somebody finally. So like for him, that would be heaven because he can't, he's like kind of incapable of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we're not hitting any of the like angsty church themes here.
We'll go. This is it. We're going to get into the themes now. So thematically and theologically, now's the time to dive in as deep as possible. Tim, what stood out to you from a thematic perspective in First Reformed? Go for it.
I think thematically, the idea of like, what are expressions of faith? So what are the practices of faith? What does it look like to be a community of faith? I think that he contrasts the football stadium style, experiential power church.
Yes, abundant life.
That's highly aligned with all these business interests that are like destroying the earth.
Yep.
And then he contrasts that to like a more contemplative approach, which would be like your Merton approach, right?
A candle on the ground, him like...
yeah, it's right? Like highly isolated, not having really connection with people. But at the same time, like dealing, who do you want to go? I mean, the first question is like the environmentalist guy said, yeah, we've been doing Abundant Life, but he didn't want to talk to anybody. He wants to talk to you. And the idea being like, if you're going through like a major crisis and maybe having thoughts of like, you know, suicidal thoughts, who do you want to go to? Do you want to go to like Joel Osteen type, or do you want to go to somebody who's like maybe the parish priest?
Right.
And the reality is like, I think a lot of us, we love to be inspired on a Sunday morning, but when the rubber hits the road and things get really rough in our lives, we need somebody that like is grounded. And who is in that contemplative mode and is into like, and who has thought through all this stuff. Yep. So not that he provides much, but like the sense being, I think, you know, even Schrader says he tends to go toward more that than he would the other way. Mm-hmm. That was like this kind of, he calls it like the American melodrama version of church. So that it would be hyped up. And he said, there's no difference between that and an NFL game.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said that he believes that people there are Christians. Yep. So he's not questioning anybody's like Christianity, but he said that what they're seeking is this, is a experience that is not necessarily church, but is the NFL or is a rock concert.
Yep.
We've heard that for years. Yep. So that's not like a new critique, but I do think that that's interesting. He's layered because he doesn't like make Ethan Hawke look like this wonderful thing. Like, this is the wonderful alternative to this horrible thing.
Yeah.
And in fact,
there's problems there too, significant problems.
And in fact, the mega church pastor like really dials into pretty immediately that he's not doing well. And he's just like, you're not willing to talk about this. We're going to have to help you get some help, you know?
Yeah.
So he's not a bad guy. So I thought it was like kind of a balance. It's kind of nice. But I think the issue is that the church, I think one of the things he brings up is the church tends to align itself with power and then it loses prophetic message.
Yes.
So, you know, what did you think about that? Did you see that too?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I think like the whole issue of politics, you know, hit home with me with just, I feel one of the major problems with the Western church these days is that we have divided everything into left and right, both theologically and politically, to the point where we've lost our ability to be prophetic and even to just share common values as believers, right? Like everything is so divided that we can't even agree on what's right and wrong anymore because, you know, either I'm going to be silent because I don't want to be political because everything's political, or I'm going to be silent because it happens to, you know, cross the party line of my particular ideology from left or right, and to give up an inch is to give up a mile. We're so partisan that to give up anything is to give up everything. And so I think that's really messed up the church. And a modern day example is for me, so climate change is the main issue in the movie. A modern day example for me would be what's happening at the border right now, right? All of us as Christians should be able to logically look at what's happening and say, hey, this is wrong. Like you don't break up families. I know there's elements of like we need to have laws and a border, but you just don't break up families. But we can't agree on that. You either have people who are just silent because, like I said, there's this idea that like, oh, we don't want to be political as Christians. But I would say like, can't we just say a current event is wrong without it being political, right?
So I think this gets into even more than that, right? Mm-hmm. So I agree with what you're saying, but I'd also say, I think that the church, the Abundant Life Church has already given up their power because they are put in a position where they have to depend upon a large corporation
yes.
to survive.
Yeah.
And so what's happened is it doesn't even, they can't speak one way or the other even. Like with any strength at all, they have to just keep on taking the checks and just being silent. So what I thought was interesting is that, I was reading this great, it's a Vox interview. Mm-hmm. It was a great interview.
Love Vox.
Done by an English major, of course, because obviously they write, but they also, would be, their literary is a good fit and a film critic. Mm-hmm. But in that he talks about organizational, that what happens is when you become an organization rather than a gathering of people, that you tend to look at the survival of the organization as your primary duty.
Ooh.
And so if the survival of your organization is your primary duty, then you're going to take the Koch brothers money. Mm-hmm. You're going to take, cause you got to have the organization survive.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I get that to a little on a micro level. Cause like I had a nonprofit. And it's a little nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
but you gotta when you get a check in the mail, you're not always going like, well, I wonder what their politics are.
Yeah.
It's like, oh good, we can keep the lights on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I get that. And so I think it's very pragmatic in some ways. It's like, well, we're in this era where the church, is it being funded by, are people tithing? Probably not. What's it being funded by?
Yeah.
So this was very realistic to me.
I love that scene in the diner where you have basically the Abundant Life pastor, Ethan Hawke, and this like oil tycoon guy, right? Yeah. And he basically brings up the whole idea of he wanted to make sure that this 250th anniversary wasn't going to be political because he heard that the funeral that Ethan Hawke did was they sang a Neil Young song, and it was and to honor this environmentalist guy, they were basically talking about climate change, and Ethan Hawke starts talking, bringing up the talking points, and this guy just like flips out, and you see that Abundant Life pastor, just exactly what you said, just like, I want to be anywhere but here, it's like I can't say anything because basically they show that this guy's giving the church about $50,000 or something, right? So it's like you literally can't speak, your hands are tied.
Like, how different is that, like selling indulgences, really?
Mm.
I mean, so like that's like so you talk about First Reformed, mm-hmm. like as far as the movie goes, right? There, and I don't, that's not the illusion, but I would say like there is some sense of like semper reformandus, like we're always, the church needs to always be in a reformation.
Yes.
And so you see this and you're like, wow, this is selling indulgences. What's going on here? There's the company is sponsoring everything. Yep. They've got their name on different fellowship halls. And at some point you go, whoa, what is happening here? It's like the wealthy corporation is able to kind of basically be in control of the church.
Yep.
So that's a problem.
Yeah.
I haven't, I haven't worked at a church that has a wealthy corporation in charge of it before.
That'd be nice.
I'm sure that exists. I don't know if it'd be nice. I'm sure.
I'm totally kidding.
Probably have an office.
We're only used to poor churches who are like right. Struggling to, yeah.
Well, we need, what is the Simpsons? Three wells is not enough.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah. So I think as far as that goes, I think it gets into ecclesiology, like what is the church? So even mm-hmm. at Abundant Life Church, they had Acts, I think it was Acts 2 or Acts 4, where they talk about the believers to sell their possessions.
Mm-hmm. And they get in the dining hall, they have that right now.
In the dining hall, it's like where people were having fellowship together and eating. And it's like, it's like a food court.
Yeah.
But the idea is like there's this huge scripture right there telling you this is what the church should look like.
Yeah.
And they're sitting in the food court of this thing.
That looks like a food court or a mall.
That
basically.
Looks like a mall.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's like, no, the believers are supposed to share, sell everything they have, share their possessions, and not get and meet every day together. And so you get this like Acts contrasted with that food court. I mean, it's just brilliant
so
what the dude's doing. But we're inside baseball, so we picked up on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So we're like, oh, look at the irony. Yeah. So anyway, sorry,
good.
I think that's one of the biggest things is the contrast of those two styles of spirituality. And the reality is like the only way that 250-year-old church or even his pastorate or whatever is able to exist is probably because of that corporation.
Sure.
So that's the reality, no matter how much he doesn't like that.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the great contrast between hope and despair, which I think is another major theme of the movie that I really resonate with, that all of us really as Christians should resonate with. You know, Richard Rohr likes to talk about the Jesuit tradition, where it's basically like you have the Bible in one hand and a newspaper in the other, right? And so balancing those two things is part of the what it means to be a Christian in the real world. You have the reality of what's happening all around us, where in many ways evil is winning, the world is falling apart, we have corruption at every turn, but we also try to hold on to hope that says that God has actually began this story and he's going to end it in a way that will blow us away. So holding those two tensions is kind of the great journey of the Christian walk, right? So final thoughts, Tim, on First Reformed? Go right ahead.
I mean, I liked it, but like, it's totally geared to a guy like me.
Yeah, right. So, we're the target audience, right?
Yeah, and Sue, I think it's good. I think it would be great for pastors to see and then discuss. Like, I know it's, I hate that format. Like, yeah. I hate that. If somebody invited me to that, I'd be like, oh, the heck, I'm going to go.
You wouldn't go.
I'm like, no, I'm not going to that. It sounds awful. So, of course, I'm like, this is a great idea. But I think like maybe for clergy to look at, because it gives you these like kind of opposing views of what clergy should be doing. Neither one of them is very balanced, I don't think. So I liked it. I'd give it an A-minus probably.
A-minus. All right.
Yeah. So I think it is jarring ending, but that's his signature. So you just have to expect that that's going to be how it is. It's not a feel-good movie. That's not what he's going for. He's trying to get you to think. It would be good for congregations to see it. I don't think it's...
Congregations.
Well, not probably in a service.
Oh, okay. Okay. You mean just like a discussion sort of.
Well, think about like what that would bring up.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
It's like, because people are going to go, oh, this guy's so jacked up, and who knows what guy they're talking about. But I would say, like, how do we deal with despair? How do we deal with pain? How do we deal with narcissists? How do we deal with all those different things within the body? I mean, it really gets to the unhealth of the body. It's like really focused.
Yes.
It's really like wide open in this movie.
Mm-hmm. So great. As I already mentioned, I loved the first like hour and change of this movie. I was like rocking an A+, like this is the movie to beat. I was about to, you know, spread it all over town. This is it. But I definitely was let down by, I would say, like the last half an hour. I don't think it was terrible. I've liked it more the more I've thought about it, and I will choose to hold the opinion that he was of what we talked about before, because we're out of spoilers now, of the former interpretation that is less
so
extreme.
Why do you believe that?
Because I want, because
do you want to believe
because
that?
I want to believe.
Yeah.
Like, because I so resonated with the first hour, because it felt like a genuine meditation on what it means to be a man of faith in the world. And I've so identified with that, and I just cannot reconcile that with the second, with the last part of it. I don't know. It just doesn't feel cohesive to me. It doesn't feel true to the character. It doesn't feel like, it feels like a totally different movie trying to jam, being jammed into the first hour, and so that's what it feels like to me. So
I think you want that ending. Like, I think you really want it to be like that, but like, this character is not a good guy.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
like that's he's not a good guy,
man. I'm telling you, I know when you start talking about his self-centeredness, I could definitely see that in every frame of the movie, and that really, in that light, it is more consistent.
Yeah.
Right. With it is the right ending in that frame of mind.
So I got to watch it
delusion.
Again, but I don't have another like 1050, man.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to wait till it comes out on something else.
I definitely want to see it again for sure.
Movies like this seem to come out on Prime all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's like movies that nobody watched in the theater and now straight to Prime.
It's the fast track.
Yep.
So I guess I would say like the last half hour is like a B- territory for me, and then A+ to the first hour. So I'm landing somewhere around a BB+ for First Reform. That's my official grade, which hopefully will change to higher even if we see it again. And I'd like to see it again. It definitely bears repeat viewings and lots of discussion.
Yeah, it's a film to study, man.
Totally. So there you have it. That is First Reformed. Go see it if you can. It might be playing in a theater near you unless you're Ron and you got to travel 2 hours for it. But it's worth it. I'd say it's worth the journey. Yeah? No?
I don't know.
Or wait for Prime. I mean, it probably is one of those movies.
You're in Kalispell, Montana.
Yeah.
Just got to keep thinking of different places.
Yes. So definitely worth your time. And if nothing else, for the discussion you're going to have in the car afterwards with yourself or whoever you went with. So As always, if you could take the time to head on over to your podcast app on the iPhone, search for Cinema Faith, and give us a 5-star rating and review, it would mean the world to us. And it really does help people find the show. I've had a couple connections with people randomly out of the blue that were like, hey, I stumbled upon your podcast. And the reason they're stumbling upon it is because you guys are rating and reviewing the show. It's how people find
it. We're causing people to stumble.
Yeah.
It's what you're right. saying, right?
We are stumbling blocks for everybody.
We are stumbling blocks for these folks.
But seriously, it takes 60 seconds. You just tap 5 stars and you write one sentence, love the show, exclamation mark, boom, that's it. And that gets the robots working and it helps other people find the show. So we would really appreciate if you could do that for us.
Yeah, it's really helpful. I don't know how exactly.
I know.
But
well,
you know more
it's
than
Apple,
me.
Man. They've got their ways. Apple and Amazon and Disney are going to take over the whole world.
The podcast is just, they're like Balk and we're like Toller.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. You should read the W.H. Auden poem.
I had no idea it was based on a real life figure. That's so cool.
It is cool.
So we will see you guys again next month. Not sure what we're podcasting on yet. It's going to be a surprise, so stay tuned. We could do another small film. We could go back to a big film, Mission Impossible. Like six.
No.
Okay, we're not doing that.
No.
I love Tom Cruise and I love the Mission Impossible franchise, but for the sake of Tim, we won't do that. It's fine.
No.
I think I'm going to do a write-up for Cinema Faith, though, possibly. Don't hold me to this, where I'm going to review every single movie in the Mission Impossible franchise. I'm so pumped for this new one. And it's just, I love it.
It's disgusting.
Don't give me that look.
That's disgusting, man. Come on, quit that.
All right, Reverend Tim, thank you so much for hanging out with me today. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.